John Grisham's The Pelican Brief exploded onto the literary scene in 1992, becoming an instant sensation that cemented Grisham's reputation as the master of legal thrillers. The novel spent an astonishing 48 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list and has sold over 14 million copies worldwide. What many don't know is that Grisham wrote much of it during breaks while serving in the Mississippi House of Representatives, often jotting down ideas between legislative sessions. When the film adaptation starring Julia Roberts and Denzel Washington was released in 1993, it grossed over $195 million and introduced Grisham's intricate legal world to an even wider audience. The book's exploration of judicial corruption and environmental exploitation continues to resonate with readers three decades later, making it a staple on law school reading lists and a favorite among thriller enthusiasts who appreciate its perfect blend of legal intricacy and heart-pounding suspense. The novel opens with a chilling scene. Elderly, liberal Supreme Court Justice Rosenberg is being discussed by Chief Justice Runyon and FBI Director F. Denton Voiles. Rosenberg, a champion of civil liberties and criminal rights, tops the FBI's threat list due to his controversial opinions. Equally concerning is Justice Glenn Jensen, the court's youngest member at 42, whose erratic voting patterns and refusal to follow security protocols make him an embarrassment to the court. Jensen, described as possibly homosexual, rejects proper FBI protection despite being sixth on the threat list. Meanwhile, at Tulane Law School, popular constitutional law professor Thomas Callahan conducts a heated class discussion about Rosenberg's controversial opinions. When student Salinger criticizes Rosenberg for protecting dope pushers, child fondlers, gun runners, terrorists, Callahan asks if Salinger wishes the old bastard would die in his sleep. The class is rescued from this awkward moment by Darby Shaw, a brilliant third-year student with striking red hair who, unknown to her classmates, is secretly involved with Callahan. As these ordinary academic discussions unfold, a deadly plot is already in motion. On a deserted pier at midnight, international assassin Kamel arrives in America. After meticulously planning his approach, Kamel infiltrates Justice Rosenberg's Georgetown townhouse, shooting the justice, his nurse Frederick, and Officer Ferguson. Later that same night, disguised as a homosexual, Kamel strangles Justice Jensen with a yellow nylon rope at the Montrose Theater, where Jensen was secretly watching a pornographic film. The president is awakened at 4:30 a.m. with news of the double assassination. His manipulative chief of staff, Fletcher Cole, sees political opportunity. "It's perfect. We didn't create it. It's not our fault. No one can blame us." The president's primary concern is that he will now get to reshape the Supreme Court with new appointments. When FBI Director Voiles arrives, tensions flare as the president demands suspects by 5 p.m. while Voiles defends his agency, explaining that the justices died because they refused proper security protection. As news of the assassination spreads, Darby Shaw awakens in Thomas Callahan's bed to see the president delivering flowery eulogies for both justices on television. While Callahan is stunned by the murders, Darby immediately formulates a theory. Someone or some group wants a different court with an absolute conservative majority. The election is next year. Why take a chance? Kill them now. Driven by intellectual curiosity, Darby begins researching in the law library while Callahan drowns his sorrows in scotch. She scans the Supreme Court's docket and appeals pending in federal appellate courts, looking for cases where someone might benefit significantly from changing the court's composition. Unlike Callahan, who believes hate groups are responsible, Darby suspects someone more calculating is behind the murders. After days of research, Darby produces a 13-page document that will come to be known as the Pelican Brief. She gives it to Callahan, who shares it with his old friend Gavin Verheek, special counsel to FBI Director Voiles. Though initially skeptical, Verheek finds the brief compelling despite its seemingly implausible conclusion. He forwards it to FBI agent Eric East, who passes it up the chain of command until it reaches Director Voiles and, eventually, the White House. The brief's central theory connects the assassinations to Victor Matisse, a reclusive Cajun oil magnate who discovered a major oil reserve in Louisiana's Terrebonne Parish. Matisse's plans to exploit this reserve through a 35-mile canal were halted by an environmental group called Green Fund, which filed a lawsuit to protect the endangered Louisiana brown pelican whose habitat was threatened. After 7 years of bitter litigation, Green Fund lost but maintained an injunction protecting the pelican. With the case headed to appeal and potentially the Supreme Court, Matisse had motive to eliminate justices who might rule against him. The evening after Callahan shares the brief with Verheek, he and Darby dine at Mouton's in New Orleans. Callahan drinks heavily, despite Darby's disapproval, consuming 2 double scotches before ordering, 2 bottles of wine with dinner, and then Drambuie for dessert. Their argument spills onto the sidewalk as Darby insists he's too drunk to drive his Porsche. He pushes her away and stumbles toward his car. Moments after Callahan starts the Porsche, a massive explosion flips the car in a violent somersault, instantly engulfing it in flames. A second explosion follows as Darby rushes toward the burning vehicle. She's knocked unconscious when her head hits another car's bumper. Upon regaining consciousness, she's approached by a man identifying himself as Sergeant Rupert, who takes her to his car for questioning by another supposed officer. Left alone, she vomits and passes out. When she awakens, real police officers reveal no Sergeant Rupert exists on the force. Realizing she's in danger, Darby slips away from the hospital, checks into a Holiday Inn, and calls Gavin Verheek. She learns her brief is circulated beyond the FBI and suspects Thomas was killed because of it. Despite Verheek's pleas to come in for protection, she refuses to reveal her location, knowing she can't trust anyone. Meanwhile, at the White House, the president meets privately with FBI Director Voiles. When the president asks Voiles to back off investigating the Pelican brief, Voiles threatens to send even more agents unless Cole stops attacking him in the press. They strike a deal. Cole will back off, and Voiles will drop the Pelican brief investigation. But Voiles secretly records the conversation, planning to use it later if needed. With Callahan dead, Darby becomes the primary target. She disguises herself with cropped, dyed hair and constantly changes hotels, using cash instead of credit cards after realizing she can be tracked. Meanwhile, the assassin Kamel arrives in New Orleans, planning to impersonate FBI agent Gavin Verheek, who has come searching for Darby. After breaking into Verheek's hotel room and recording his phone conversation with Darby, Kamel kills Verheek with 2 precise blows, first crushing his larynx, then delivering a fatal strike to the base of his skull. He arranges the scene to look like a suicide, positioning Verheek's body on the bed and firing a small caliber pistol at his temple. The next day, Darby arrives at the Riverwalk shopping area to meet who she believes is Verheek, identified by his black sweatshirt and red baseball cap as they had arranged. The man is actually Kamel in disguise, carrying a handkerchief to explain his altered voice and claiming to have a cold. As they walk together toward the Bayou Queen paddle boat, a gunman suddenly appears, pushing through the crowd and shooting Kamel in the head. In the chaos, Darby slips away, realizing the dying man was speaking Egyptian, not English. This shocking twist reveals another layer of complexity. The CIA has been monitoring the situation and intervened to save Darby. The man who killed Kamel was Rupert, a CIA operative assigned to protect her after the agency learned about the Pelican brief. Victor Matisse had sold part of his oil project Prolithia, bringing CIA attention to the case and creating a web of competing intelligence agencies, all pursuing Darby for different reasons. While Darby is running for her life, Washington Post reporter Greg Grantham receives a mysterious call from someone identifying himself only as Garcia. The nervous caller hints he might know something about the Supreme Court assassinations, but is too frightened to share details. Later, Grantham receives another call from a woman who identifies herself as the author of The Pelican Brief, Darby Shaw. Darby challenges Grantham to verify her information before she'll reveal more. Meanwhile, she continues evading her pursuers, narrowly escaping Stump, one of the men hunting her, by creating a distraction with Saints fans on Bourbon Street. After several close calls, she eventually arranges to meet Grantham in New York, taking elaborate precautions to ensure she isn't followed. When they meet at the St. Moritz Hotel, Grantham is struck by her youth. She's only 24 to his 38, and her transformation from the long-haired woman in photos to her current short, dark-haired appearance. Despite her caution and fear, she agrees to tell her story, warning that they will both be hunted once it's published. Darby explains her theory about Matisse and mentions two Washington law firms involved in the case, White and Blazevich, a very old, powerful, rich Republican firm with 400 lawyers, and Brim, Stearns, and somebody. This information electrifies Grantham, who connects it to his mysterious source, Garcia, a frightened lawyer who had almost shared crucial information about the assassinations. Determined to verify Darby's theory, Grantham and Darby launch an investigation to find Garcia. They discover he's likely a lawyer at White and Blazevich who saw something incriminating. After obtaining a list of summer clerks who had worked at the firm, they methodically interview each one, showing them a surveillance photo of Garcia. After multiple rejections, they learn from a student clerk that Edward Linney, their last hope, has dropped out of school and is being detoxified at Parkland Hospital. At the hospital, Darby finds Linney, who immediately recognizes Garcia as Morgan from the oil and gas section on the ninth floor. With this crucial information, they learn that Curtis D. Morgan had called Grantham three times before his death, which was reported as a mugging gone wrong. When they visit Morgan's widow, Beverly, she reveals something crucial. 2 weeks before his death, Curtis had purchased $1 million life insurance policy with double indemnity for accidental death. More importantly, while going through his personal desk, she had discovered a key to a lockbox at First Columbia Bank, a bank they had never used before. Inside the lockbox, they find a videotape of Morgan explaining his discovery, a memo on White and Blazevich stationery from M. Velmano to Sims Wakefield stating that research is complete and the bench will sit much softer if Rosenberg is retired. The second retirement is a bit unusual. Einstein found a link to Jensen, of all people. The memo mentioned the Pelican should arrive here in 4 years, assuming other factors. Morgan's affidavit explains that Einstein is Nathaniel Jones, a legal genius kept isolated on the sixth floor. After copying the memo, Morgan had been confronted by a furious Wakefield who demanded to know if he'd read it. Later, Morgan found evidence his office had been searched and possibly bugged. After the assassinations, he was convinced Matisse was behind the killings and feared for his own life, fears that proved tragically prophetic. With Morgan's crucial evidence finally secured, Gray and Darby establish themselves in the Washington Post newsroom, their contrasting work styles on full display. Gray's desk becomes a hurricane of scattered documents and hastily scribbled notes, while Darby meticulously arranges her materials in precise stacks, each annotated with detailed references. Through the newsroom's vast windows, Darby notices dark sedans with tinted windows circling the building, a chilling reminder that Matisse's network remains active and watching. The duo works through the night, crafting a story that would shake the foundations of Washington power. Their draft connects the dots between the Pelican Brief's predictions and the subsequent murders, laying bare the conspiracy that reached from Louisiana oil fields to the highest offices in the nation. Gray's colleagues at the Post watch with growing fascination as the story takes shape, recognizing they're witnessing history in the making. When it comes time for comments, Gray's calls set off a cascade of revelations. His first call to the FBI yields an unprecedented response. Director Voiles himself arrives at the Post within the hour, breaking protocol to address the magnitude of the situation. The FBI chief's presence sends ripples through the newsroom, with veteran reporters noting they'd never seen such a high-ranking official respond so quickly to a story. Fletcher Cole at the White House responds with calculated precision, confirming Matisse's $4.2 million campaign contribution, but adamantly denying any White House interference. His practiced responses belie the panic clearly evident in his voice, each careful word suggesting deeper concerns about what else the reporters might know. The most dramatic response comes from Marty Velmano at White & Blazevich. When Gray confronts him with specific details from Morbin's memo, particularly the damning passage about their client's interests being served by the justice's removal, Velmano's characteristic legal arrogance crumbles. "You don't mind ruining people, do you?" he asks, his voice heavy with defeat. "You son of a bitch," becomes his final admission of guilt, the words of a man watching his carefully constructed world collapse. FBI Director Voiles' official statement proves explosive, confirming receipt of the brief and its immediate transmission to the White House. But it's his off-the-record revelations that truly illuminate the depth of the conspiracy. He reveals recording equipment in his office had captured the president himself requesting a slowdown of the investigation, a revelation that would prove devastating to the administration. Voiles also fills in crucial gaps about Kamel's murder of Gavin Verhaeghe and identifies Darby's mysterious savior in New Orleans as Rupert, a deep-cover CIA operative who had been tracking the assassin's movements. The story's impact becomes clear as phones throughout the Post begin ringing incessantly, other news organizations scrambling to catch up, sources offering additional information, and Washington power brokers seeking to position themselves ahead of the impending storm. As the story breaks across all networks, the White House scrambles to contain the damage. Press Secretary Zickman delivers a nervous statement admitting the president received campaign money from Matisse's channels, but denying any impropriety. He claims the president met Matisse only once as vice president and hadn't spoken to him since. The fallout is swift and severe. Cole resigns to take the fall, though indictments seem unlikely. Velmano, Schwab, and Einstein are indicted, but Velmano disappears. Matisse and four associates are indicted, with more to follow. At White & Blazevich, Sims Wakefield, a 42-year-old father of six, distraught about facing his family, commits suicide with a .38 pistol, thinking of his life insurance policy as his final act. Darby, exhausted from running and hiding, negotiates with Voiles to fly her on his FBI plane to a destination of her choosing, where she can disappear. She insists on changing destinations mid-flight for security, eventually making her way to the Caribbean through a series of flights designed to lose any potential followers. After 8 days in the Caribbean sun, Darby has regained her natural hair color and developed a tan. She's moved into a white Caribbean-style beach house at Maho Bay on St. John that costs $2,000 a week. The secluded house faces the water, with the nearest neighbor barely visible through the trees. That evening, Gray arrives by taxi. Their reunion is warm and immediate. After changing into shorts, they walk along the beach together as Gray updates her on developments. As darkness falls, they agree Gray will stay for a month. "Let's take it a month at a time," Darby suggests, and Gray finds it perfect. A tentative new beginning after weeks of terror and tragedy, with justice served and the truth revealed. Behind the thriller's plot lies a sobering environmental reality that Grisham skillfully incorporates into the narrative fabric. For centuries, Louisiana's coastline was shaped by the intricate natural battle between the Gulf's encroaching saltwater and the Mississippi River's life-giving freshwater and sediment deposits. The river's annual floods built vast, lush wetlands spanning thousands of square miles, creating one of North America's most productive ecosystems, teeming with crawfish, shrimp, oysters, and hundreds of species of birds, fish, and wildlife. This delicate ecosystem remained in balance until 1930, when oil was discovered beneath the marshes. What followed was an unprecedented transformation of the landscape. oil companies dredged 10,000 miles of canals through the wetlands, creating a maze of channels that allowed saltwater to infiltrate deep into freshwater marshes. These canals, some as wide as 150 feet, acted like knives slicing through the wetland fabric, accelerating erosion and destroying the natural hydrology that had sustained these areas for millennia. By the time of the novel's writing in the early 1990s, 60 square miles of Louisiana were vanishing underwater annually, equivalent to losing a football field every 45 minutes. This process continues today at an even more alarming rate, with some estimates suggesting that Louisiana has lost nearly 2,000 square miles of land since the 1930s. The destruction has far-reaching consequences, from decreased hurricane protection for coastal communities to the collapse of commercial fishing industries worth billions. The endangered Louisiana brown pelican, central to the novel's plot, serves as a powerful symbol of this environmental devastation. Once abundant along the Gulf Coast, the species nearly disappeared in the 1960s due to pesticide pollution and habitat loss. Though conservation efforts helped the pelican recover somewhat, its struggle for survival mirrors the broader battle to protect Louisiana's vanishing wetlands. The legal battles fought over wetland preservation, often pitting environmental groups against powerful energy companies, reflect the same tensions that drive the novel's main narrative. Through this environmental subplot, Grisham elevates The Pelican Brief beyond a simple thriller to a nuanced commentary on how corporate greed can threaten both natural ecosystems and the very foundations of justice. The novel suggests that when enough money is at stake, nothing is sacred, not endangered species, not the rule of law, not even the lives of Supreme Court justices. This interconnection between environmental destruction and corruption becomes a metaphor for the larger themes of power, justice, and accountability that run throughout the book. Perhaps the most compelling aspect of The Pelican Brief is its portrayal of how a single determined individual can expose corruption at the highest levels. Darby Shaw begins as an ordinary law student with exceptional intelligence and curiosity. Her initial research into the murders of two Supreme Court justices starts as an academic exercise, a theoretical exploration that quickly evolves into a dangerous pursuit of truth. When confronted with these high-profile murders, she applies her legal training to develop a theory that the established authorities either miss or deliberately ignore, demonstrating how fresh perspectives can illuminate blind spots in official investigations. Despite losing her mentor and lover in a car bombing, being relentlessly hunted by professional killers, and discovering corruption reaching to the White House itself, Darby perseveres. Her courage manifests not just in dramatic moments of escape, but in the daily choice to continue gathering evidence when every instinct screams for self-preservation. She demonstrates remarkable resourcefulness, using her legal knowledge, forming strategic alliances, and leveraging media connections to protect herself while pursuing justice. Her journey from academic theorist to reluctant activist illustrates how ordinary citizens can become extraordinary agents of change when driven by conscience and conviction. Curtis Morgan emerges as an equally powerful example of quiet heroism, the corporate lawyer who recognizes wrongdoing within his prestigious firm and chooses to act. His position gives him unique insight into how legal firms can become complicit in corruption, and his response demonstrates that ethical behavior often requires sacrifice. Morgan's meticulous documentation of wrongdoing and careful arrangements to ensure the truth would emerge after his death reveal a different kind of courage, the methodical, calculated kind that plans for justice even beyond one's own survival. Through these parallel narratives, Grisham explores different faces of moral courage. Darby represents active resistance, the warrior who fights in real time against visible threats. Morgan exemplifies passive resistance, the witness who ensures truth will survive even if he doesn't. Both characters demonstrate how systems of justice ultimately depend not on institutions alone, but on individuals willing to stand for truth regardless of personal cost. The novel also examines the ecosystem that enables or threatens such individual courage. It shows how media, particularly through Gray Grantham's character, can amplify individual voices and provide crucial protection through publicity. It demonstrates how power structures, from law firms to government agencies, can either support or suppress individual efforts at reform. In a world where institutional power and money often seem to determine outcomes, the Pelican Brief offers the hopeful message that individual conscience, combined with determination and intelligence, can still triumph over corruption and greed. This message resonates particularly in our current era of whistleblowers and citizen journalists, where individual acts of courage continue to shape public discourse and drive institutional change.